This is Inside the Magic Studio with your host, Robert Martin, the interview podcast with the best in Magic the Gathering. Thanks to GatheringMagic.com, where you can find this show and some of the best articles in Magic, along with Cool Stuff, Inc. The guest for this show is Zach Hill.
What got Zach Hill to want to be a developer for Magic the Gathering?
That's a really, really good question. You know, I mean, on one hand, it's, I've been playing Magic since I was 8 years old. I think everybody that's played this game has really gotten passionate about it, has thought about being able to be sort of behind the scenes making the cards. But what really turned it from sort of an abstract interest in me, making card designs on the brainburst forums in the late 90s, was actually when I moved to Malaysia on my Loose Fellowship. Basically, I was doing consulting work for the government out there and working for an organization called the Center for Independent Journalism on a fellowship that was deliberately designed to sort of take Americans and place them out of their comfort zone and confuse them and shock them. And that was part of the experience. So I was talking to all the other Loose Fellows who were, sort of plopped down in places like Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, China, rural China in some cases, barely knew the language and were having trouble meeting people and having this really sort of isolated, sort of transcendent, but difficult, but very professionally challenging experience. And I was just having the time of my life. I was just having a blast. And the reason was that I was writing for Star City around the time that I moved to Malaysia. And the local Magic community had just this giant upwelling of support for me, and was really sort of welcoming and excited to have me around. And they introduced me to their families. They introduced me to the gaming community there. They played Magic with me. They introduced me to a gaming store. They helped me sort of, learn not only Bahasa Malaysia, but when that I should stop trying to using it because I was really bad at it. All of these things. And what I realized was this game that I had been playing for so long was connecting me with people in real visceral ways across, the boundaries of language, of culture, of religion, of society. And that was just a magical, powerful experience to me. Because my passion ultimately lies in connecting people with experience and helping people create meaning from experience. And I figured that Magic would be one of the most powerful ways I could discover in doing that. And I thought that, by making this game, I could help ensure that the experience that I had wasn't limited to me, but could really be something shared by millions of people around the world.
Who made the offer to you to come work for them?
It's kind of a funny story. I've been writing a lot of articles about Magic for a long time. I've, sort of been a pretty common Pro Tour player for as long as I can remember. I mean, my first Pro Tour was in 2001. I kind of gravy trained from 05 to 07 and played at a few Pro Tours in 08. And so I've been around a while. And I kind of developed friendships with Randy, with Aaron, with Matt Place in particular, but largely Aaron, and Tom LaPelle, I had known from the PTV scene for a while. So I kind of just one night in Malaysia got the courage to draft them a sort of long letter about exactly why it was important to me to come work for them. And I think the sum total of, being a Loose Scholar, the work that I contributed to the Magic community, the work that I'd done in deck design and the work that I'd done as a Magic player kind of made me a reasonable candidate. And I went through a sort of brief interview process and they said, okay, we'd love to have you in. So I think if I had anybody, most of all, to thank, it would be Aaron Forsyth for really kind of kickstarting me and helping me be persistent enough to really get the job.
When you first got there, what were some of the challenges that you had to overcome?
That's a really good question. That's a really multifaceted question. First of all, there were some just readapting to life back in the States was hard. I moved to Seattle with a woman, and cultivating that relationship when our first 4 dates were in 4 different countries, that was hard. Getting used to living in Washington was itself hard. I hadn't driven a car in a year. Right? I had to learn lots of. So there was all that stuff outside of work that was extremely difficult to get used to. And then there was stuff on the inside. I had to learn, you know, six Magic sets worth of cards in a week, you know, so I could start building decks and start, you know, and really being able to contribute usefully. And that was, you know, kind of anxiety inducing for a while, because normally when you're playing Magic as a player, you get to get used to the metagame gradually. You know what cards are powerful and what cards aren't. You see one set at a time. But when, you know, you're going from Shards of Alara, whatever block was, Lorwyn Shards Standard, to Zendikar Scars of Mirrodin Standard, or at the time Zendikar Enlightened, you know, it's a lot to process, especially when you've never seen anything like Rise of the Eldrazi before, right? So just getting used to all of those cards was extremely hard. I guess the second thing is just being a good developer means having a keen sense of when the things that you like to do are not the things that are good for Magic as a whole. And that is a skill that, again, you have to sort of work to cultivate.
Isn't that difficult with the fact that most people come in there and they think, I'm going to come in and change how design goes?
Yeah, I mean, you have to have some intellectual humility, too. You have people like Eric Lauer, who's ridiculously talented, smart. People like Mark Rosewater, whose vision of the game is, you know, extremely solid and iconic and robust. And you have to show up with a healthy sense of not only what your limits are, but just with an appreciation of what everyone around you is creating. I think that very quickly I became cognizant of my own limitations and my own areas where I can contribute, and the talents and skills of the people around me. And I think that just being mindful of that, being appreciative of that, helps you kind of calm down your own, not only your own ego, but your own preferences, right? Of just realizing that the people around you are like talented, reasonable, smart people making talented, reasonable decisions. So if there's something you vehemently disagree with, you really need to have a very good reason for it. So it definitely, yeah, you want to come and you want to start making cards, you want to sort of leave your mark on the game, but you've got to have some confidence that you're going to be able to do that, and you're going to do that in a far more effective way if you understand the system that you're working with first, and ensure that your contributions after that are actually valuable.
So you've been a part of some of the most, well, obviously most popular, well-sold sets ever in Magic.
It's pretty awesome.
What is your vision of R&D in the future?
You're very good at this job. I understand why you have this. What's my vision for R&D now that I'm away from it? I guess I'm going to kind of unpack that question into multiple parts. The first is, you know, the my part of the equation. What do I think I added to R&D that leaves my mark into the future? I mean, obviously it's a matter of degrees. I think we all had really robust visions for the game. I think we all were in symbiosis around a lot of the things that mattered. I think the thing that I was sort of adamant about was that I did not perceive a dichotomy between simplicity and quality, or simplicity and strategic depth. And I think the set that I'm extremely proud of that embodies that is Magic 2013, of which I was the lead developer. But I think we got some really, really, really great gameplay out of that set while still delivering a really coherent, straightforward, comprehensible experience. And I think that, you know, I mean, beginning with New World Order under people like Devin Lowe, Mark Rosewater, Matt Plates, Eric, Tom, obviously that foundation was set, but I think I was sort of the big voice of saying, no, let's see how far we can take it. I think we can make a greater game than we've ever made while making a more simple, intuitive, accessible, visceral game. So that's the thing I hope that I contributed, that I carry forward in the future. As far as R&D as a whole is concerned, I think the focus toward wanting the things that feel good in Magic to be the things that are good in Magic for the bulk of players, I think, is kind of the big revolution over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And on one end, that's a subjective claim. Everyone has things that they really enjoy about Magic, and Magic is never going to be one-dimensional. I mean, obviously, Magic is designed with the needs of all of its players. But I think that when you deconstruct what a game of Magic is all about, why it's not just kind of a card-flipping exercise, it comes down to the mana system and having meaningful effects from 1 to 7, not just 1 to 3 or 1 to 4. And it comes down to creatures and creature combat. These are the things that make Magic distinct from other engines of its type. And a commitment to making meaningful creature combat kind of the baseline, so that things like combo, things like control, things that are really off the wall, are when they arrive, they're special precisely because of where the baseline's been set, and aren't just sort of a ubiquitous thing, which actually I think diminishes what makes them cool and what makes them impactful for the kinds of players that like them. So I think an understanding of what R&D is really good at, totally independently, is a great understanding of what, at its core, Magic is all about, and really engendering things. Because I think you see that in things like the standard environment. You know, right before Gatecrash was released, we had the most diverse, longest tail standard format of all time. With also a record number of, by every conceivable metric, it is great. Magnificent environment. And I think that's just a testament to R&D really hitting their stride and really understanding what makes the game tick.
Well, let's get into one card in particular.
Oh, yes.
That drew the ire of the Magic community.
Oh, yes.
And that would be Snapcaster Mage.
What
was the original design of Snapcaster Mage?
The original design of Snapcaster Mage actually was a slightly tweaked version of this. Well, the first thing is Tiago, good friend of mine, he submitted like 4 different cards. All of them were ludicrous, right? There was an island, there was a counterspell, there was, in essence, a free counterspell. There were all these crazy things. So we're like, look, let's make a creature whatever. So Tiago was talking about wanting to cast a creature, literally to make like a magic player, right? And, you know, you want a wizard to cast spells. Like, that's really cool. So he's like, what if I make a card that when I cast it can cast stuff from the graveyard? Well, so we're like, okay, that's sweet. And he's like, okay, I want to make it cast instants, but only at instant speed, and sorceries at sorcery speed. Well, unbeknownst to him, we put Flashback in the Innistrad. So it seemed kind of like the perfect fit. It was. And the card played out. We played a lot of it. It was a lot of fun. The thing that we failed to appreciate were 2 things. First of all, for whatever reason, the card did not get entered into the master database in Multiverse with Flash. It was just a translation because, like, I was working with Tiago to make the card, but someone else owned the file. So for whatever reason, it didn't get entered into the database with Flash. I knew that it had Flash, and I was playing it like it had Flash. But a lot of other people didn't know that that was the intent of the card for several weeks until it was in the file, until someone caught it. So it wasn't like the end of the world, but it meant that Snapcaster Mage was not getting tested with the rigor that it would be under circumstances. The second thing that happened was we just did not appreciate how powerful the triumvirate of Gitaxian Pro, Ponder, and Mana League was. We had plenty of Mana League decks, we had plenty of decks with Potter, and we didn't realize how easy it would be to really make a Snapcaster Mage deck with, like, 18 to 20, like, Faber Snag's a great example, just one mana instance that really capitalized on the power of it. So, and those decks are really hard to build. They're actually a lot easier to build in a real-world metagame where you have, like, a bunch of stuff that you can kind of, like, react to, which is why blue decks are their specialty. So, like, inside R&D, our blue decks tend to be worse than average to begin with, and so it created kind of like a perfect storm of just failing to appreciate certain powerful elements of the card. And it's an extraordinarily powerful card. The other big thing to remember about invitational cards, it's kind of risky with them. We don't like, in general, to say, this card we want to be a tournament staple. We embed variance and we embed uncertainty into the power level of a lot of cards. So we say sometimes, like, we want this to be played, But we don't want to say, like, we want this to be a 4-up in every deck. We used to do that. It's very bad. We don't do it anymore. But with invitational cards, I think even though our policy isn't different, the temptation is like, okay, someone won a big tournament to make this. We don't want to give them the lame card that sucks. Let's try, I think we err on the side of power with invitational cards, even if we're not trying to, in ways that produce, some of the just most powerful magic cards of all time. And I think that's just a risk with the kind of invitational process. And something that we, got better at normalizing to a degree, but contributed, I think, to what happened with Snapcaster Mage too.
Did you think, when the players got frustrated with it,
yeah,
did you take it personally?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's rough to see people upset. It's rough to see people upset with the thing, that you make and do all day. So, I mean, I think it's saddening to see so many people that have negative experiences with the things that you work really hard to create. That's a bummer, I don't think we took it personally because I think that our process allows for the making of mistakes. That's what embedding uncertainty into the system means. If we can predict metagames perfectly in advance and card power perfectly in advance, the 12 of us or however many of us are playtesting at a given point, Magic wouldn't be robust enough to be enjoyed by the millions and millions and millions of players. So I don't think we took the power over the reaction to it personally. But I definitely think it can be very disheartening and saddening to see the things that you try to create to make people have fun and enjoy themselves to produce so many negative experiences. And then, of course, you get into the moments where, people start to personally attack you. And I think that is a different question from whether the reaction to the card itself is something you take personally. I think in our best moments, do we take it personally? No. In our human moments, do we take it personally? Yeah. And that's unfortunate.
The Magic community seems to be very fickle.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's okay.
Doesn't that make your job more difficult if the people you're dealing with are just that way?
I mean, I think I really hesitate to get into a mode of thinking just in general where, I don't like to generalize people. I don't like to, blame people. I don't like to say that, this large group of people is wrong about a thing. But what I do think is true is that, with all of us, every single member of Magic Development had a Pro Tour Top 8 at minimum before, joining the team at the time that we were working on this. Since then, Tom's come in and out or whatever, but Tom was still an established PCU player, Humphreys and Terry would have Top 8. So it's easy to forget as someone that's played Magic since you've been 8 years old, someone's played Magic at the highest level, that just most players do not play nearly as much Magic as you do, right? Even the ones that do, this is your job, right? I mean, you play Magic for 8 hours a day. And that doesn't make your opinion more correct. And certainly being inside R&D, you get wildly worse at understanding and predicting the game because you're not in the real world. But I think that it's important as a developer to realize that the feelings that people are having are real feelings and genuine feelings, while also understanding that the reasons that they are articulating for having those feelings may not hold up to the scrutiny that you're applying to the problem as, definitionally one of the top, one-tenth of 1% of all the set of Magic players. And that's not because we're that great. It's just that anyone that's ever played on the Pro Tour, much less had success in it, much less has top eight in it, is in the top mega upper echelon of Magic players. So what you have to do is divorce their feeling, which is real, and you've got to take it seriously, from the mechanics that they're expressing, you know, from exactly why they're saying they have that feeling, and then really deconstruct, like, okay, why are people not happy now? Or in some cases, saying maybe people are happy and it's a vocal minority that isn't happy. And again, the rough part of that is when people, you know, when your audience goes from being upset at a play experience to really going on the attack of you and your work on a personal level. And it's, again, just a challenge, right? Because, you know, everybody in R&D does nothing but give their lives to this game that we want people to enjoy. And no one, I've never seen a member of Magic R&D act in bad faith about something. But there's sometimes an attitude amongst, like, the vocal minority of Magic players. There can be a sort of implicit smugness and, like, lack of willingness to extend that same good faith to other people that is just very disheartening and kind of almost despair-inducing in a way. It makes you feel very distant and disconnected from the experiences of other people, which can be very saddening. There's a gulf sometimes that grows between you and the players. When you spend all your time trying to make the players happy, it's a beating, you know?
I understand that completely. Let's get back to something a little more positive.
Yeah, for sure.
What was the card in development that you designed that was the most memorable card you made, but they looked at it and said, that just is not going to work?
Oh, man. Well, there was Gravecrawler, but we printed that. it's actually a card that isn't out yet, but you'll see it in Dragon's Maze, the set and the other set that I developed. And basically we tried literally 20 wordings of it before we could get it to work. And we finally did. But I had been told that that card couldn't be printed easily 15 times. But we did.
Well, what made you insist so hard to have this card work?
I don't want to talk too much about it. It's not out yet. I think it's a super cool, loud, awesome, dynamic thing. Like, really just a really viscerally rewarding experience. And when I see something that I know the play pattern is going to really engage people as human beings and not just like magic aficionados, I'm willing to push for it really hard. So that's why, without giving it to
you. Absolutely. Was there a card you made that disappointed you?
Yes. The first card that I expected to be just wildly insane was Mass Polymorph. I never did really anything in the real world. Although I think I have a really, really good Mass Polymorph. There had to have been a Phyrexian Obliterator. We really, like, we knew when we printed Dismember in the same set that it might not take off, but that was a card that we, like, really put a lot of chips on the table for, and it is objectively, like, an insanely powerful card, but never really was able to find its wings for a number of reasons. So I think, and Percy and Fat Mother was sort of in a similar boat of these, like, ludicrously powerful five drops, or four drops, that just didn't have a home somewhere. So those would kind of be the ones that stand out to me.
Okay, without giving too much insider secrets, the last few sets, you've come up with the two colorless, two black, 6/6 demon.
Yeah.
Every time it seems like it's going to be good, every time it doesn't seem to make it.
Right there.
Were there some designs that would have gotten there?
It's hard to say. I mean, I always thought Abyssal Persecutor was bad, and I wound up being okay. And, like, Obliterator's Fringe, I guess, Vanguard is, like, not really. The one in Ravnica, I think that card has some promise. I honestly do. I think it's, you know, it sort of got hit by Ultimate Price, which is, you know, it was a card that we put in to return to Ravnica because we thought Standard did not have quite enough playable spot removal, and it's still low, but intentionally so. It's at a level I like, where you're really having to make meaningful choices of removal spells. Is it something that we're like trying to put in there to like see, oh, okay, will it ever reach a point? No, not really. But the thing that those cards highlight is, especially in a color that doesn't have ready access to Mana Acceleration, you can make a really awesome, appealing creature that attacks and blocks. And you have a lot of room to be liberal with the power level of that card. So, I wouldn't interpret that as predicting anything in the future, but I think that highlights, how you can push a creature in a way that makes it really cool, in a way that makes it something that you're willing to look at for constructed without busting the format in half.
You did get to play a little competitive Magic.
Yeah, yes.
What was that like for you?
Man, oh my goodness, man. It felt, honestly, the way I described it, it felt good to be home. It was hard. I had not sat down to play 10 grueling rounds of Grand Prix level Magic, 11, I guess it was, or maybe it was 10 rounds in a day. I hadn't played in a Grand Prix without buys since 1999.
Wow.
Yeah. On one hand, it was just like being 2008, 2009 again. I was testing with Sam Black, one of my best friends. VU is awesome. Our deck was great. I contributed meaningfully to the deck, which felt good. And we did pretty well with it. So all of that felt great. And the fact that I still knew what was going on felt great. Definitely, I'm rusty, that's for sure. I on day two especially, I think I played day one pretty well. Part of it was it was important to me to not embarrass myself on the way back. Part of it, I just wasn't as fatigued. But definitely by round, 14, I was straight up on autopilot. And I forgot Celestia Charles in the format. I, made ludicrously bad attacks sometimes. I mean, Magic is a hard game.
Really? Magic's a hard game?
I know that's right. But no, man, it felt great to be.
You got to work with two of, well, I guess you want to consider Magic's contemporary deck designers.
Yeah.
Z obviously, through his Hall of Fame career, had his hands all over different decks. And exactly. Nowadays, Sam Black has been compared to Z. Whether they agree or disagree on that, I'm not sure. But they both have that meaningful deck design that they're willing to take chances.
Yep, exactly.
When you sat down and talked to them and you listened to them talk about the cards, how much of the player came out of you, or how much did the R&D guy come out of you?
It's interesting. It was mostly player. I was mostly wearing my play hat, and part of it is that I've always talked liberally to Sam about game design. It's something that he's a consummate gamer. He's fascinated by it. I obviously love it and passionate about it. So I've talked to Sam about game design a lot. I've talked to Zvi a lot about game design since I moved to New York and since I really got to know him as a guy. A really impressive dude outside of Magic, really growing to become one of my favorite people. But when testing for this tournament, it was very, my player hat was on. Part of it, I know that, I can't play at a Pro Tour for the next 2 years or something like that until Huey comes out, because I can't play in tournaments that are within 30 days of a release. But they can. So I know that they needed to do well at the event. I know that they couldn't just sit and indulge in luxury in, abstract theory about game design. And part of it was just important to me to do very well. So it was mostly Zach Hill, the player, talking. But we can definitely geek out over game design in some moments.
You obviously, as most people that know you, have gone into coverage.
Yeah.
When they first approached you to doing coverage, what was your first thoughts about doing it?
Oh, I was super excited. My first event coverage was with some sort of Grand Prix in 2003. And I did Pro Tour coverage of Pro Tour Kuala Lumpur in 2007, and at least one or two Pro Tours before that. So I'd done tech side coverage for a long time. I was doing magic videos from back when Evan Irwin's magic show was like a new thing. So I think it made sense for me to be a person that, you know, gets put in front of the camera to do analysis. I love it. I have training in acting and things like that, and voice acting. So I think it was a natural person to approach for it. I'm really excited at Montreal. We're getting like a lot of really awesome, robust professional training. It is super exciting. And I'm glad that Wizards committed to really taking coverage to the next level. I was part of the conversations from the R&D side about the evolution of the Pro Tour and the decision to make it so much more like heavy online coverage, heavy investment, video features, awesome stuff. And so when they tapped me to say, hey, would you be part of making that? And it was a dream come true, honestly. I mean, I've now been involved as an author, a player, a game designer, and a member of the media team in like really significant capacities for a long time now. And it just feels really amazing. And even a little, like a lot of business side stuff with the integration of Magic 2013 and Duels and the Planeswalkers and all that stuff. So with coverage, I really felt like I finally made like real contributions that I was happy about and can be proud of to like literally every element of the Magic universe. So it was really kind of a dream come true for me on top of all the rest of the stuff. It was really awesome.
You just talked about all the changes. A lot of it has to do with the fact that both Wizards of the Coast and Star City Games have both changed how we view coverage.
Right, exactly.
Where do you see it going?
You know, I did a really fun event one time with it was for a Duels of the Planeswalkers promo with a guy named Oscar, a StarCraft commentator on LA, and I really enjoyed the vibe of that. I mean, the level of magic being played was like, you know, people having fun playing magic, but the thing that was exuded from the coverage was just fun. It was just a bunch of people having fun. Panzer, who's now on like a show on TBS. There's a bunch of really just cool people who enjoyed magic and were playing it and having the time of their lives. And I really want and this is not to say that I want this at Pro Tour coverage, because I think Pro Tour coverage is the time to showcase magic's greatest talent and magic's greatest technical mastery and you know, real true visionaries of the game. But I'd love to see more coverage too of just like people really experiencing the fun and connection and unity that Magic has to offer too. I don't know how to realize that, but it's something that I think is tremendous untapped potential. I think when it comes to Pro Tour coverage, you're going to be seeing just a lot more, not just like people playing Magic, but a real telecast. Something I really liked at Pro Tour Return to Ravnica, where each of us had kind of our own little video spots that deconstructed a certain element of the game. Those were really fun to, and I think created a narrative in a satisfying way. We're gonna try to get even better at the act of sitting in the booth, the act of analysis before and after. We want, obviously, a lot more spotlight to be on the players. So player interviews before and after matches, players coming into the booth to talk about games, players doing deck techs. I mean, we understand, as much as I like to hear myself talk, and I know you know that, we shouldn't be the focus. The focus should be on the players. And Greg Collins, a guy that doesn't get a lot of credit, a true brilliant guy, the guy behind Magic coverage. You know, went to Stanford, really smart. I could talk to him about every subject from literary criticism to magic to gatecrash drafts to sport. I mean, just awesome, awesome guy. He sort of has the reins of magic coverage right now. He has for a long time and has a great vision for what he wants to enact. So I can honestly say, not just as a member of the coverage team, but as a member of the magic audience, that I'm really excited to see what comes out of magic coverage over the next 12 months.
You've worked with a lot of people on coverage.
Yeah.
Is there someone you haven't worked with that one day you would like to?
That's a hard question to answer because I don't know if there's anybody I haven't worked with. I've been in the booth with Patrick. I've been in the booth with everybody at Star City. I've done a couple of Star City things on and off. I'm really excited, actually, for Tim Willoughby, a good friend of mine. He's going to be in the booth at Pro Tour Gatecrash. That should be a lot of fun. And, I mean, Brian is one of my best friends on the Pro Tour, Brian Kibler, and I guess I'd really love to sit down and cover a match with him some.
Normally, I don't like to delve into the fact of my own personal relationships when it comes to this, but my son is 9 years old, and he plays competitive Magic at FNMs. You were part of the last set of Junior Series in Magic.
Yep.
It is gone now.
It is.
And someone like my son, who would be able to really take advantage of this, there's no opportunity for that. He's either at FNM, Star City, GP.
Right.
Yep. Is this something that you think that they should look at maybe redoing?
Yeah, that's a great point. I loved the Junior Super Series. I played on the GSS from 99 to, I think, about 2002. And it was 2001 when I played my first Wizard and wasn't eligible anymore. But it's one thing while I was at Wizards that I really wanted to bring back. And I wasn't ever able to get a ton of momentum around. But, my mom is actually who got me into competitive Magic. I was doing all kinds of stuff when I was, 13, 14 years old. I was really into martial arts. I mean, black belt Taekwondo. I was playing tons of soccer, lacrosse, theater, all kinds of stuff, chess. My mom took me aside one day after I won a Magic tournament. She's like, son, I'm never going to tell you what you do and do not need to. I'm never going to make you do anything. I will point out that when you win one of those chess tournaments, you get a trophy. And when you win one of those Magic tournaments, you get $1,000. So I encourage you to take this Magic thing seriously. And it was awesome that my parents, because so many people I know are not, my parents were so supportive of Magic. And that was directly because of the JSS. And I think the JSS manages to legitimize Magic in the eyes of a lot of parents in the way that a few other things can. And I also think it's just a great experience as a kid to, you're not having to go in and play against. My first Pro Tour, my opponents were Ryan Fuller, Noah Bogan, and Mike Long. Were my first three opponents, right? That is the Shark Tank. Being able to play against people that were playing Magic for the reasons I was and be competitive, but in a safe kind of exploratory way, was one of the best experiences of my life, and arguably is why I was able to make it on the Pro Tour. A lot of the reason I was able to spend $0 in college, a lot of the reason I was able to travel around the world. So I do miss the JSS, and I do think it has the potential to be a really good program. And I'm sad that there aren't more opportunities for people like your son to be able to play competitively in that way. Because I also think it's a great thing for kids to do with their parents, and the JSS sort of helps get them to that level. So.
You put on a post why you left Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah.
You just talked to me a little bit ahead of time before we started recording about how much this means to you, what you're doing. Can you tell the people what you're doing and why it was so important for you to leave Wizards to go pursue your dream?
And honestly, the last word to use, pursue your dream. That's what we're all about. We're about connecting people with their dreams and turning those dreams into realities in tangible, actionable, powerful ways. And I guess the reason that's so important to me is because that's so important to me. That I don't think there's anything more relevant and resonant for a person than to realize that their dreams are not these abstract disappointments that rest on the horizon of their lives. They're instead things that you can wake up and pursue the second you get out of bed and with the whole fiber of your being. And that really is the movement that we're trying to create in schools right now in Washington, D.C., New Haven, and in New York, but eventually across the entire United States, of engaging with the richness of your life in total ways and of making your dreams as much a part of your day-to-day experience as the coffee you drink in the morning. And that is what we do. And you can go to www.thefutureproject.org to learn a lot more about us. But I cannot think of something that is more important and that I would love more to dedicate my life to than this. And it was a hard decision to leave Magic, but it feels like the right decision. And I love my life right now.
Sometimes an interview can be more than the sum of its parts. Zach had so many stories to tell, and yet in this short format, I can only scratch the surface of the ones that I wanted you to hear about. You can anticipate in the future that he will be a guest that will be back on the show. You can reach the show at themagicstudio1@gmail.com or on Twitter under The Magic Studio. Again, thanks to GatheringMagic.com for hosting this show and to Cool Stuff, Inc., and thanks for listening.